Welcome to Them Before Us on American Family Radio, where we strive to put children before adults. Our goal is to educate the public on a child-centric perspective of marriage and family and represent the rights of children on policy matters. Now, here's the host and founder of Them Before Us, Katie Faust.
Welcome to Them Before Us Radio. I'm your host, Katie Faust, founder and president of Them Before Us, here with my executive director, Josh Wood, where we're going to talk a little bit about the plight of young men today. There certainly has been a lot of attention given to young women, especially around the Lindsay Clancy trial and young women's strange and disturbing responses to a woman who very clearly is responsible for the death of her three young children. But we want to turn our attention to young men. Before we do that, we always start with a little bit of Bible time. And this week I drafted an article in response to listening to several different passages of the Old Testament, specifically the Judges and the Prophets, critiquing their own population for intermarrying. This was a great offense and reason for judgment, and sometimes leading causes of the exile of the people of God. They were intermarrying with people who were not Jews, that rejected their God. So it was primarily a metric of idolatry. And therefore, these women, these foreign wives, were leading these men astray. And God actually called for pretty significant responses to those who were marrying foreign women. There was supposed to be a rejection of the community of God. Sometimes there was like very strict punishment for them. So it made me think, because I was contacted by an old friend of mine who said, Katie, I just really appreciate your Substack articles on how to hold the line on traditional marriage while loving our gay and lesbian friends. And she shared the story with me about how when her brother said that he was going to marry his boyfriend, that she and her parents said, we love you too much to go to this wedding. We will not go. And she talked about how there were other ministry leaders at church, other extended family members, other childhood friends who all went to his wedding. And it was she and her parents who said, we are the lone Christians who will not go. Now, there has been a lot of controversy. This is probably the number one question that Christians ask when it comes to rubber meets the road decisions on how do we hold fast to our convictions without unnecessarily alienating people in our life who disagree. I think a lot of you guys have wrestled through this. Anyway, I wrote an article that has not been published yet called In Praise of the Family Who Stays Home. And basically the idea is this. Weddings in scripture are not a private decision. And it is not something to be thought of as this is a springboard for future evangelism or ministry to a person with whom I disagree. This is actually a reason for communal judgment. Now, judgment came on the Old Testament followers of God for intermarrying women. And yet somehow we think that judgment is going to pass over us for what is very clearly an idolatrous relationship because they are rejecting the created order that God has made plain in Romans chapter 1. And they're not marrying women. They're marrying other men or other women. So at least in the Old Testament, the children created through these interfaith unions were being raised by their mom or dad. The children that are going to be created or grafted in to same-sex unions will lose their mother or father. And yet somehow there's a cohort of Christian voices and Christian leaders trying to normalize, trying to massage, trying to even make people feel guilty for saying, I'm not going to the wedding, as if that's a hateful response, when the reality is that is a response that sticks very, very closely to what God commanded in the Old Testament and the New Testament. So Josh, thoughts on that? It just keeps coming up in my world of what do I do? Should I say yes or no to the invite? I think it's a clear no, because we had clear no's about something much less severe in scripture.
Well, I'd be curious. It's like a tactic, I think, Katie, that maybe people call it tone policing. Somebody posted in response to that article, basically, why did you post this? And someone, luckily, I mean, one of the other people that follow us said something to the effect of, because they believe in prioritizing the needs of a child over this adult celebration. And, you know, the person basically said, you have Christian in your bio. Do you not agree? And the person was like, well, you know, it's actually just, they're not winning any friends by saying it the way they said it. They need to be more concerned with how these people feel, because us, you know, making enemies, going after people. And, you know, this was a post about two women who had created a fatherless child. And they were kind of, again, policing the tone. And it did strike me that, like, if you're a Christian, and I think if you're not a Christian, we can set that aside for a second. But if you're a Christian, it is incredibly hard to justify legitimizing this event with your presence. In my mind, we hold so much significance to what it is, and honestly, what they want it to be, which is equality, marriage equality, is the whole thing. There is no logical conclusion that if you believe that they should have full equality and they can redefine the institution, there's no reason you can stop them from saying you can't have children, you can't create children. It kind of follows that if you want them to have full equality, you have to grant that. Well, as a Christian, you just can't go there. And so you really do have to decide, am I, you know, if I'm trying to just preserve this adult's feelings, am I going to go to this to make them feel good so I don't avoid the confrontation? I don't want to ruin the relationship. What happens when it's a baby shower in 6 months? What happens when it's celebrating this fatherless child in a year? Will that have been worth it? Or are they going to say, no, I always knew you were a hypocrite, but you already sacrificed and went to this marriage ceremony, but now you won't come to my baby shower? You won't celebrate that? I mean, it strikes me as like the confrontation is coming. It really is a question of, do you believe it's wrong in principle? And I think I love the way they framed it, that I love you too much to lie to you by going to this, you know, this celebration.
What I hate, and there's a long list, what I hate is that there have been voices that claim to be Christian who are trying to say, this is good. It is good to go to the wedding. It is loving to go to the wedding. It's actually what Jesus would have done. Jesus would have gone to the wedding because they are elevating unity and relationship above the truth. That's really what they're doing. And it's totally out of step with a lot of other commands that we have in scripture. I mean, Christ himself said, I didn't come to bring unity, not even to your immediate family. I came to bring a sword. The truth will divide. And I think that this question, this invitation, is the place where we are going to test our convictions. More than vaccines, more than Trump, no Trump, more than even abortion, this is the place where faithful Christians are going to wrestle the most with, who do I serve and what do I prioritize? And unfortunately, I think that there has been a simplification, which is really an adulteration of the gospel, boiled down to love God, love people. And obviously that was in response to a lawyer asking Jesus to summarize the law. And the law itself talked about loving the least of these by protecting the fatherless. So there's no way that the love God, love people is going to be able to green light the participation in a union that will manufacture motherless and fatherless children. So I just want to like give a shout out to the people who have stayed home, the mothers or the fathers who say, I love you and I won't go to your wedding. The brothers and sisters who say, all the people that are going there, they don't love you as much as I do. And then all of the family that have said, I'm going to serve you better. I'm going to try to sacrifice more for you in these other areas where it'll be clear that I want you, but I will not bless what God does not bless. And I know that there's probably people in your immediate world, maybe even at your own church, who said you made the wrong choice, but I am here to say you made the right choice and you will not be put to shame for that choice. You will be vindicated in heaven and maybe vindicated on earth as well, because you will be the one person representing Christ who has lived consistently in the life of your sibling or your child.
Well, Katie, and not to get kind of into what I'm trying to anticipate the questions that we'll get from this. What about that couple that promises, we're with you. We would never create a child like that. We just want to get married. That's it. We're just trying to be committed. We're not even going to have an open marriage, which, again, if you dig into the rates of open marriages within LGBTQ relationships, it's horrendous. It's not like heterosexual marriage in historically. But if you have that kind of perfect edge case, that person who doesn't want to create children, I think it helps to, again, if we're trying to equip people listening to us to have these conversations and they say, well, I'm not going to create children. I agree with you. And I agree in principle with what marriage should be, which is lifelong and monogamous. You know, I think it's helpful to just dive into what marriage it was for as even a social, you know, discovery that this is how we unite the two people to whom a child needs. It wasn't an invention. People didn't just sit around and go, you know what would be great if we... No, they recognized that this covenant creates the stability necessary to unite and attach the father to mother, mother to child, child to father, like all of that together where we then got this result in society we needed and that the children, the justice that the child needed, which was to have both of those partners and how that redefinition actually impacts the stability of that union.
I'm in a bit of an online scuffle right now with the head of the Log Cabin Republicans. That is the official wing of the GOP that is seeking to advance LGB, lesbian, gay, and bisexual priorities within the conservative party. I wrote an article critical of them last week in Real Clear Politics about how if they want to advance issues of sexual orientation, including marriage, and adoption, and by that they mean same-sex parenting, they can't be conservative. It's totally out of step with what the founders of both our country and the Republican Party set out to do. The Republican Party explicitly said, we are here to destroy the twin relics of barbarism, polygamy and slavery. And I said, well, what the Log Cabin Republicans are doing is advancing another redefinition of marriage, same-sex marriage, and another version of the commodification of people, big fertility. So they just wrote back and created their own op-ed. You know, Katie Faust is welcome to her opinion, but it's not historical or logical. And I'm like, oh, it is. And because they're like, gay marriage isn't like polygamy because that was multiple people, but we're two consenting adults. And I'm like, it is like polygamy because marriage actually has a specific form. That form serves society by serving children. What characteristics does that relationship embody that serves children so well? One of them is monogamy, to reject more than two people. One of them is permanence, that it's going to be lifelong. But one of them is complementary, that it involves both a male and a female, because that's what it takes to make new life. When you don't have a male or female and you want access to new life, that means you have to buy them. So they're objecting because they're saying, oh, gay marriage isn't anything like polygamy. And the answer is, you're right, it's not. Polygamy was much more recognized, normalized, and it actually has a historical basis. Gay marriage is something else altogether. It's never been seen before in culture throughout all the centuries in every country. You have had homosexual behavior. Nobody's recognized gay marriage. So anyway, I said, hey, you want to debate? We'll see what they say. My guess is no. Because they don't have a historical, philosophical, biological, or sociological leg to stand on. Their only metric is, does it serve me? And the answer is, yeah, it sure does. But it will always victimize children.
Yeah, I think that's the big challenge, is this does... This redefinition, when words lose meaning, when terms lose meaning, when covenants lose meaning, we lose something as a society. And the reason people don't see an issue, I think, personally, is because they've completely lost what this institution was originally designed for.
Yeah, and it's not designed for adult validation. It's not designed as a tool to give people, quote unquote, dignity. It is the way that a government unites the two people to whom children have a natural right, their mother and their father. And we at Them Before Us, along with the American Family Association, are a part of the Greater Than Coalition, greaterthancampaign.com, and we are going to take marriage back, regardless of what the Log Cabin Republicans have to say about it.
Welcome back to Them Before Us on American Family Radio.
We're back at Them Before Us Radio. I'm your host, Katie Faust, here with Them Before Us Executive Director, Josh Wood. And we want to turn our attention now to young men. There were a few articles that came out this week that caught our attention as it relates to the plight of young men, the struggles that they're having, the distinct ways that this current cultural moment is ensnaring them and dragging them down. This is something that I have a lot of interest in because I have a 16-year-old son and an 18-year-old son and a lot of contact with their friends. So I see some of the trends that they are working to fight, and I see a lot of the temptations and cultural snares and technological snares that are really robbing them of the ability to live a fulfilled life. So Josh, tell me a little bit about some of what we were reading this week at the Institute for Family Studies.
Well, yeah, they're tapped into something right now that I think is resonating with a lot of people. I think it's honestly, we see it in our politics today, that we are polarizing. I think young women and young men see the world so incredibly differently. I think you mentioned the Lizzie Clancy case in the intro, the first segment, it as a flashpoint. What scares me is there's increasingly a very small number of people who have worldview overlap. And I actually, in prep for this segment, was reading something from Russell Bertrand. And if you don't know him, he is essentially a philosopher, and Bertrand Russell. Oh my gosh, sorry, I mixed that up. He wrote something in 1929 that I found totally fascinating, and it has to do with this article on IFS. He said, among human beings, the cooperation of the father is a great biological advantage to the offspring, especially in unsettled times and among turbulent populations. But with the growth of civilization, the role of the father is increasingly being taken over by the state. And there's reason to think that a father may cease before long to be biologically advantageous. And at any rate, in the wage-earning class, if this should occur, we should expect a complete breakdown of traditional morality, since there will be no longer any reason why a mother should wish the paternity of her child to be indubitable. Okay, keep going. My belief, though, is that I put forward in with some hesitation that the elimination of paternity as a socialized recognition would tend to make men's emotional life. So if we fail to recognize that fatherhood means something, that relationship means anything, I think men's emotional life will be trivial and thin, causing in the end a slowly growing boredom and despair in which procreation will gradually die out, leaving the human race to be replenished by stocks that had preserved the older convention. So societies that cherished paternity. That was written in 1929, that if we make men irrelevant, if we make procreation a possibility outside of marriage, where women can have children or can fulfill themselves without men, essentially saying if men aren't needed, you know, what happens in life? And so you take that frame and apply it to this article from IFS. This was by Joseph Davis. He's exploring why men feel adrift under today's individualist ethic, which forces men to invent their own identity and career from scratch since old social supports are gone. Okay, here's a couple of the key points. The individualist ethic as the water young men swim in. Davis argues that the old scaffolding, social relationships that used to give them meaning, family, neighborhood life, predictable careers, have collapsed. And now men have to build their values from nothing. They're not born into a story and into a community of relationships and dependencies. They're essentially adrift, if that makes sense. And they're having to start from scratch. Who do I believe? What does it mean to be male? 73% of young men don't know what manhood means anymore. 73%. Three quarters. That's insane. Redford turned down elite universities to stay near his friends and was treated as a failure. So the person in the study was treated as a failure for staying close to home, to having those connections. Again, I'll give you just two more. 85% of young men say manhood requires sacrifice for others, and most still want to provide and be present fathers. So even though we see this polarization between men and women, what they're finding is in this individualist ethic, as men are trying to discover themselves, they're still saying, I actually just kind of want to be a dad and I want to work hard and bring home money for my family and provide for them. And that actually sounds really good. And they did say that. They said that high status careers, as they get older, that shine wears off. And they're like, you know what? A family that just depends on me, that they can't outsource, is actually the most significant thing in life. Now, what's hard is we don't always realize, I speak for myself. You ever heard the term born on third base thinking they hit a triple? I think sometimes we are born on third base and don't realize how much manhood, provision, and marriage and family being the source of happiness being ingrained into us is a cultural advantage. And how behind a group of people will be if they're born with a clean slate, belonging to no one, fatherhood meaning nothing, masculinity being toxic. Now go figure out your life. Go figure out how to have a meaningful life. How detrimental that would be to being, a young man.
These findings definitely show that men are adrift and they're aspirational. Like they want something more for their life. They want to be responsible. They want to get married. And yet they are really suffering. Half reported chronic loneliness, isolation, feeling unloved. 4 in 10 have 2 or fewer close friends. 61% feel like they have little control over their own lives. 42% calling themselves a failure. Now, I would love to see the breakdown of the kids who are really struggling with isolation and defeatism and hopelessness with the ones that grew up with a loving, connected, intact family. Because I do think that, like Bertrand Russell said, predicted, that what the state gets wrong is we're not just economic creatures. We're relational creatures. We're not just widgets that need a career. We're people that are born into a specific union with specific people. Those people form us. They're committed to us. We need more than just monetary provision. We need relational connection. We need it primarily from the man and woman who made us. And when you're feasting on that kind of relational health and wholeness and longevity, that's when you're able to have a springboard. That's third base, right? There is something that you need to do for yourself, choices you need to make. Good parenting is going to channel their children's choices and interests and personalities towards productivity. It's very, very hard to do that if you have completely fragmented or no relational foundation to begin with at all. So I think that there is a direct connection between a lot of the hopelessness that young men are experiencing and the fact that we starved them. We ripped out from under them the pillars that they need to thrive. I thankfully am surrounded by a lot of incredible young men, teenagers, and now college students who are doing very well. Some have chosen to go to college. Some are doing some kind of vocation or trade. But these men are good men, but they all had dads. They all had dads that were taking them to T-ball practice and then moving up through their Cub Scouts with them and apprenticing them at their own work or showing them how to play the trumpet like they played the trumpet. You see the intellectual kids coming from mothers and fathers who got philosophy degrees. So you can see that sort of generational handoff as it relates to interests and abilities and even vocations. I mean, it does build a level of confidence. And that love that they got from their mother or father allows them to have a fullness of heart to then start to develop those healthy peer relationships. So we need to be really honest about how young men are struggling. And we need to go upstream and say, a lot of them are struggling because we have ripped apart the scaffolding that they need to start to develop some of these healthy understandings of themselves as a young man and themselves in relation to the rest of the world.
I think we take for granted that society 50, 60 years ago, for all of its faults, had far more neighborhood associations than today, far more civic organizations. One of the things they note in the study is how social, civic, and religious participation have gone down. I was fortunate enough to be a pastor for several years, and we had actually a campus in Canada. And so I got to go visit. And it was shocking how, if you don't know anything about Canada, their welfare state has expanded over time. They're essentially 10, 15, 20 years ahead of us. So people don't feel the same desire to give to organizations and charities and even churches, because they've assumed the state's job is that. It's almost like, you tax me, so you take care of it. We again, and I believe the acceleration has actually started under Reagan. We began to, maybe LBJ with the Great Society, we began to see the government taking on things that used to be neighborly activities. It's almost answering this question of, you know, can the government love my neighbor? Or is that my job? And I do think the cost, we often don't stop and say, is this a load-bearing wall, before we knock it out. And what's happened is, through these civic organizations, these churches, these civic societies, through even social relationships and clubs, people formed bonds and knew each other. And so if you needed help, you knew who to call. You knew who could watch your kids, who could give you a loan, who could, you know, all these different things. We don't have that anymore. And I do think, Katie, I've been processing this. I think there's something to the male psyche about being, not feeling needed, not feeling depended on. And so when a male finds far fewer marriageable women, far fewer women interested in that at all, fewer and fewer who want to be provided for, they have no civic societies. Everything they are known for, aggression, strength, even good violence, like the type of violence that protects people, that's all toxic. What is it, a surprise that where they've gone is the vice economy? They gamble to get a thrill. They play video games to escape, and they watch porn because they're not connected to anyone. I mean, that seems to be the outlet they've chosen.
Men are definitely at their best when they are shouldering a load. That must begin with personal responsibility, right? You can't be responsible for other people if you can't be responsible for yourself. So it's really important, parents, that you train up your young men. Obviously, we think this is true for young women too, but there really is something distinct about men needing to do hard things, carry heavy burdens. First, they learn to do that themselves, as it relates to how they govern their time, their money, their energy, their own sexual impulses when they are young, because they will do better. They'll feel better about themselves. They're actually going to reach their full potential when they take responsibility for others, specifically a wife and children. This is an area where we run into some significant difficulty, because especially marriage-minded young men have fewer and fewer marriage-minded young women that they're going to be able to date and eventually marry. This is an area where we need to do two things. We need to equip our young children, our sons and our daughters, to think about marriage sooner rather than later as the cornerstone in their life that they establish sooner rather than a capstone that they put on the end of a life where they've gotten degrees and, you know, made their way up to the management and paid off their loans and bought a house, and then they get married. At that point, it's harder to find alignment as it relates to worldview and compatibility. But if you do that in your early 20s and you build a life together, then you get to grow together and mature together. But this is something else that we can do as a church, as a community. We can be more purposeful about creating spaces where young people can come together. If you're at a church and you don't have a young adult group, you could simply say, hey, twice a month, I'm going to have everybody between the ages of 18 and 25 over to our house for a barbecue, and we're going to play Codenames, or we're going to play Catan, or something like that, where there's a chance for them to interact with one another, and then realize, you know, in-person life is better than online life. Or where the girls will have a chance to say, well, you know, I've been told that marriage and career, that career is more important, but actually now that I'm with this guy, he seems to be pretty nice. We have to bring back those in-person opportunities for young men and young women to be together. And then I would say, parents, it's important that if you send your kids to college, you need to tell them this is not about your career or your grades primarily. This is an opportunity to look for like-minded peers, other guys. I'm sorry, look, guys look for girls, girls look for guys, where you have worldview alignment, where you've been able to study their character, where you're doing things together that you both enjoy, and then you should prioritize healthy dating. If you miss that opportunity to send your child to a college, if they don't find somebody in college, it's not impossible afterwards. It's just exponentially harder because the pool is so much smaller. And now you've kind of skipped over the window where that youthfulness can be paired well with mature commitment and you can grow together as a couple.
I would say too, the cultural propaganda is going to get broken through individual testimony. I do think it's our testimony, especially as in this stage, I'm in a different stage. I've got young kids. Always to all of my friends, making sure they know, of course, we always have our hard days, but on social media, in person, how amazing this is, how fun it is to cut logs in the backyard with my boys. That is so fun and a blessing, and money cannot buy that. Dropping $60,000 on some sports car or whatever, or vacationing around, can't beat being in my backyard with my boys. Or a grandfather who leaves a high-powered job and says, nothing beats being on a boat with my grandkids. This beats any boardroom I'm in, stock options. It's that type of testimony, which we've heard, that cuts through the propaganda that tells you, be all about yourself.
We definitely need to critique a culture gone astray, but that's not enough. We have to model the good life. Reveal it, not just to the people in our in-person world, but in the online space too. We all need to, in essence, be evangelists for marriage and children so that the next generation know that it's something to look forward to, not something to dread.
If you'd like to comment on the show, email comments@thembeforeus.com.
I'm your host, Sam, and I'm joined by Jen, and we are here for the comments. So Jen, what are we getting into today?
Well, this was kind of a big report that broke from the Times. I think the Times is the UK, not to be confused with like the New York Times or something, but a little bit disturbing. And we want to inform people and give you that children's rights perspective. So basically the report said between 2019, when single people gained the same surrogacy rights as couples, meaning a single person, like I want to be a single dad or a single mom by choice, they were allowed to use surrogates. But then in just this last year, 170 single men applied for parental orders via surrogacy. And the data showed that 83 of that 170, so over half, were 40 to 49 years old. And 24 of that number were 50 years old to 59 years old. We've talked about this with Emma Waters, and Heritage did a big study with this as well when we looked at foreign nationals coming over from China. And I remember the number being kind of distinct. It was like 40, 40, 40. It was like 40% of the surrogacy contracts, I think this was international, were coming from Chinese men who were over 40 or wow, older, right? Something along those lines. And you can go fact check us at Heritage. They have a report on surrogacy, foreign national surrogacy. So some of the other stats from this, most single men pursuing surrogacy are over 40 years old. Some of them are in their 60s and 70s. Surrogacy for male couples, so gay men, is up 191% since 2015. And most British surrogate babies are born abroad, meaning born outside of the UK and then brought back in. And we've talked about this a little bit before. A lot of the surrogacy agencies are using women in Latin America. They're using women in Africa. They're using women that are in poor areas that are more desperate for money and probably not giving them even the star treatment that maybe surrogates might get in the United States. We're finding, I think it was, there was a place in China. It was basically looked like a farm with, you know, dorm style housing, where they force the women to stay and, you know, you're not supposed to walk around a ton. You're being given medication and food and blah, blah, blah. I think because they're taking care of the product, but they're being mistreated in terms of their own human dignity. So what are some of the other things that we saw people saying or reacting to around this, Sam?
Yeah, I want to jump into those comments, but also it's funny to me because, you know, what's in the news these days is the Lindsay Clancy case. And my first thought when I think about these children who are being conceived to single parents by choice is, you know, you look at this Lindsay Clancy case and there's so many people who are saying either she didn't do it or she wouldn't have done it if she didn't have support. And if her husband was helpful, he's the worst husband. And so it's like this idea that like, you know, if her husband had been more helpful, she wouldn't have been alone in this. And it's like, well, what about parents who are completely alone, who don't have a spouse to do life with? And you know, there are cases that happen like that on accident because someone passes away or somebody just leaves somebody and it's really tragic and we can all see that. But there are people who are choosing to do this where they have no life partner, no spouse, and they just want a child. And they could be 60 years old and all they have to do is go through surrogacy because they would be denied with adoption. So they just go through surrogacy and they have a child all by themselves. And especially these people who don't realize what having a child is like, how much work it is, and how much the child needs you and how much you need your partner to be able to be a good parent. And so it's just so crazy to me that they look at this Lindsay Clancy case and they want to blame the husband because he's not being supportive, yet then they turn around and they support things like surrogacy for single parents who have no support. And like, how do you think that's going to turn out for those kids? How do you think those kids are going to be raised? Probably by a very stressed parent. So just wanted to point that out. I feel like it's very hypocritical. There are a lot of comments. Go ahead.
Let's just point out too that if Britain is going to make it illegal for their own people to be surrogates, which is a lot of the reason that you go contract it elsewhere, you might have some strict rules. China, you're not allowed to be use a surrogate for your own children in China. They have to they're allowed to use surrogates for other things, or you have to go get a surrogate somewhere else. So that's why all these men are coming to you. Well, I think there's other reasons they're coming to America and having a baby here and bringing it back. But it's just interesting. It's like, you think it's bad, like you don't want your women used as surrogates, but you're allowing your people to go use other women's bodies. So we need to tighten that loophole for sure to start.
Right. And honestly, you know, some people will say, well, we don't need to completely ban it. Let's just like put some regulations on it like other countries. But the truth is like, there's not enough regulations in the world that would stop the child's rights from being violated. That's the reality of what we're dealing with. Like surrogacy 100% of the time violates the child's rights. And so it's not enough to regulate it. I mean, I'm not opposed to some regulations, better than nothing like what we have in the US. Like I'd like to see some regulation, but ultimately I really want to see it be completely banned because that's the only way to protect the rights of children completely when it comes to surrogacy. So I have some of these comments here on X. There's always fun things to read here. Somebody said, single men in their 70s with life expectancy of what, 79? How is this legal? That's what we want to know. That is a good question. How is this legal? Again, these men would not be approved to adopt a child for good reason. So if you can't adopt a child, why are you allowed to contract a surrogate and basically purchase a child that way? And it's honestly, it's just because it's unregulated and legal. So that's how they can get through doing that. Did you have any idea or comments about that?
Yeah, I was just thinking, I mean, this is not true in every case, of course. There's perfectly lovely, safe, healthy people who are not married yet. Mm-hmm. And there's people who didn't get married for a variety of reasons, or they lost their spouse early on in the marriage and never got remarried, whatever it is. But if we're talking about a man who's in his 70s, 60s or 70s, he's never been married or has lost his wife a long time ago. And what are we looking at to say that's okay for you to contract and purchase a child, a little kid, and bring them into your home? And we've talked about how predators use these loopholes because to my knowledge, it's not currently illegal for a predator to go use a surrogate. Mm-hmm. Because most people, that's not really been on the radar for a lot of our legal, a lot of jurisdictions. So there was a case where a man who had some developmental special needs, I believe he was a mailman. He lived in his mom's basement contracted and got triplets.
Oh my goodness.
And because he didn't want all of them, it was another one of those scenarios where he was trying to force the woman to abort. She refused. The babies were born. They were in his home, and then he was not taking care of them. I mean, their diapers weren't being changed. They weren't being fed. And they got taken and put into, you know, CPS, took them. And they're trying to like suss out the contract law of who's allowed to have custody of the children. So there's all these things where, because we're treating humans as property, well, nothing should bar a man with developmental disabilities buying a doll online, whatever. He wants to buy a toy. He wants to buy some materials. He wants to buy tools. We're not regulating, you know, people with different special needs or people who are single or old from buying products.
Right.
But these are human beings. And so why aren't we using some kind of vetting to show this person is a safe person before they're allowed to buy a child?
Yep. That is a good question. It's wild. Again, when you view children as a product, there's no reason why they shouldn't be able to buy one. There is a lot of people in the comments, luckily, who can see how wrong this is. There's someone who said, global ban now. Totally agree. That's my page. Another person said, children are not for sale. I mean, technically they are right now. That's the problem. So I think this person would be on our team if we could get them activated. Let's see here. It said, another person said, child abuse made legal by politicians. And that is true too. Like, you know, our government, a lot of people want to say like, oh, the government needs to stay out of these things and the government shouldn't be telling people what to do. But the truth is, like, our government, bare minimum, should be protecting the basic rights of citizens, and that includes children. And so again, when you look at it from a child rights perspective, the government has not only like every right to do that, but the duty to ban it. And so it's one of those things where, you know, some people just don't agree with how the government is supposed to be run.
I'm just seeing this video where, you know, and we don't know how real it is. Anybody can just record themselves and say that something happened. And so, but this is a young woman who says that someone she met through Facebook Marketplace is saying, if I become his surrogate so he can have children, he'll help me with the money I need for my apartment.
Oh boy.
He'll help me with my living costs. And also he only wants a natural conception.
And then thinking, it's like that. There's a name for that. There's a word for that. Like, that's wild.
The thing is, I think young women are being lured by thinking this, you know, I could have $20,000.
Yeah.
I could have $100,000. Even the women that are being sucked into going about it the right way, like mm-hmm. an agency, and it's all documented and we do all these things. Yeah. But they're the only authority that they have to appeal to, right? They're not falling under some government regulation. They're making up their own standards. And people will say, no, surrogates get background checked. First of all, the surrogate getting background checked is not as much our issue, though. Okay, I guess, great. Again, if you're going to do it, maybe it's good to have the surrogate have a background check. We're talking about the person who's taking the child home
right.
having a background check. Are the surrogacy agencies vetting clients? Why would they do that? $100,000 is $100,000. Why do they care who gets the child? And so, again, just think about it as a marketplace. It doesn't have regulation. So mm-hmm. even in a very stark, I don't care, children can be products, this is the free market, let people do what they want. If you wanted to take that view, you still have to come back and say, but you're not going to have any government regulation about who can do what in the transfer of human bodies from, and human gametes and human bodies from one person to another. You're not going to have any oversight. Yeah. Most people, I think, would think that's pretty crazy. But I think a lot of people don't even know this is happening.
Yeah, I think the average person doesn't realize how bad this is. When they think of surrogacy, they probably think of like, oh, my sister couldn't have a baby, so I just had a baby for her. But it was like her egg and her husband's sperm. And it was just a really sweet story. And unfortunately, that's not the reality of what we're dealing with. And that's just the gateway into all this other evil stuff. I mean, that's evil too, but on a different level.
Well, yeah, that's called altruistic surrogacy. Mm-hmm. And the flip side of it is called commercial surrogacy.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this is a Heritage stat. 98% of surrogacy contracts are commercial.
Yeah.
Money paid and exchanged. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Because really it's money that rules this. Like, people don't generally do this out of the kindness of their hearts. You know, that of course those people exist, but majority of the time people pay big money to make this kind of stuff happen. And like you were saying earlier, I think some people would say, well, you don't need a background check for the person who's taking the kid home, because most of the time that's probably their biological father, which is true sometimes, where it's like their sperm that's being used. But the problem with that argument is surrogate children have mothers. And so that child still has like an egg donor, or like you said, it was, you know, a conception that was with the surrogate herself. So when you are like creating a child and there's a mother and a father involved, then like the mother selling her child to somebody for money, because that's what, you know, people who sell their eggs, they don't donate their eggs. They sell their eggs. They make money off of this. There still should be, like, again, it's like adoption, because you're taking the parental rights from one person and giving it to another person. And so we definitely need some kind of background check or regulation or something along those lines.
Yeah, for sure. It's just so crazy how these things so far surpassed our laws around them. Like, the industry decided it was a good thing to do long before we had any of the laws in place. And I was thinking as well, I believe it was New York, or this might have been one of the M states, Massachusetts or Minnesota or something, where gay men, it was only altruistic surrogacy was allowed. And some gay men wanted to buy a baby and they couldn't find a woman who wanted to do it for only paying her medical bills. Someone will be like, yeah, I'll do it for $200,000 with an agency, but I'm not doing it for, you know, my medical bills. So no one wanted to do it altruistically. And then they sued saying, this is a violation of our right to have a child. We have a right to do whatever we want, to have a family. And you can use Obergefell for that. And so the state changed the law to open it up to commercial surrogacy.
Wow.
Because they have a right to another woman's body, and they have a right to another woman's gametes, because they want a child. That's what intended parentage is, the uniform parentage laws, right? So it's so messy, and it's really just about what do adults want and how do they want it, and let's accommodate them. And Them Before Us is trying to reorient everything around, I understand that you want that, and that might be a good, okay thing to want, but you cannot do it in that way because it violates the rights of children. And we always have to come back to that. That's all the time we have for today, you guys. Thanks so much for joining us on Here for the Comments, and we will catch you next time.
See ya.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.